Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest is undoubtedly one of the most influential guitarists in alternative music. Along with his band Sonic Youth, he pioneered a rock guitar sound that had never been heard before, taking the hardcore punk ethos, DIY ethics and experimental avant-garde approach and creating a new musical style. He's also renowned for his unconventional approach to the guitar, using unorthodox tunings and unusual tools on his instruments. Over the 30-year tenure, Sonic Youth have evolved from cult to hero status, and many of their albums are regarded as modern classics. Since their split in 2011, this week's guest has continued to write and record, though, and released his latest album, Rock and Roll Consciousness, earlier this year. My guest on The First Time this week is Thurston Moore. Here we talk about Thurston's earliest musical passions, his first record, that epic by Iron Butterfly. We also discuss the first Sonic Youth gigs, their key influences, John Coltrane and Patti Smith, the triumphs and troubles they enjoyed, and the end of the band. Plus, we hear Thurston's thoughts on being regarded as an axe hero. But I started by asking Thurston, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
There was always music in my household. My father taught music. Classical music was always sort of in the house, and that's always what I thought of music until I heard my first rock and roll record.
What was your first rock and roll record?
It was my brother, who's 5 years older than I am. He brought home Louie Louie by the Kingsmen. That was really remarkable because it was short and it was really economical, and it was just like it did its thing like in 2.5 minutes, as opposed to, like, you know, these long symphonic pieces that I was always kind of swirling around in the house. And that was really amazing. And it had vocals. It was a singer, and he sounded really kind of, like, you know, bored and aroused at the same time.
You've kind of got many of the lessons of rock and roll are contained within that one track, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. And then my brother was, like, trying to convince me that he made the record. And so I was like, well, at that age, I mean, I was probably all of, like, 5 or 6 years old or whatever. I kind of believed him, you know, like, maybe he did. But how? But, you know, who knows?
Are you going to do another one?
Yeah.
Maybe.
And what was amazing about that record was the flip side of it was an instrumental called Haunted Castle. Which had this really mysterioso two-note back-and-forth kind of organ guitar thing. And to this day, I still reference that. Like, you know, that kind of... That structure of that song is really, really influential to me. So that record's big. That first rock and roll record is really big for me. I think I still have it. But there might be a few holes in it, because we used to throw records in the air, and we had BB guns, and we would shoot at them. I think that one might have a few BB gun holes in it.
What about the first record that was yours? Because that's a different thing. You're sort of going out, and you're picking an object to bring back, and it, especially if you've got family, this is your one.
Well, the first record I got was through the good graces of my mother, who bought a record for me because she allowed me to pick out a record. And I picked out Inagata Davida, the album by Iron Butterfly.
Heavy.
It is a heavy choice. And I'm not quite, and I think it had to do, it was pretty much by suggestion from my older brothers. Like, this one's good. Like, get this one. I was like, okay. You know, I was just a little tyke. And I was just like, and I brought that home. And that became my record. And I played it incessantly. And at first, it sounded really bewildering to me because, it was a California psychedelic group, but they were, you know, they were kind of, you know, it was kind of straight down the middle, like, you know, organ, guitar, drums, you know, nothing super flourishy until you get to that long Inagata Davida track. And it was all about the drum solo, you know, everybody's solos on that song, you know, and it's a sidelong song. So, you know, thinking about it right now, talking to you, it's like, maybe that's why the songs on my new record, everybody's saying, but they're so long. They're like such long songs. It's like, yeah, I don't know why. Now I know why. It's because they didn't get a DaVita. In a God of a Peter, honey, don't you know that I'm loving you? In a God of a Peter, baby, don't you know that I'll always be true?
I want to ask you about John Coltrane. I want to ask about the first time you kind of, that you found his music.
Because John Coltrane?
Yeah, because his music is important to you.
I believe it had to do with the jazz record collection that existed in Kim's household in Los Angeles with her family, her mother and her father and her older brother. And I would have gone there probably around 82. And there were these records. And I was like, oh, these are those records, like these Impulse records. There was Mingus, there was Coltrane. And I just would stare at them. And I was like, everything about them aesthetically was just like really curious to me. Their weight, you know, the heft of these records, the design aesthetic. And I started to play them. And in a way, that kind of inspired me to find out more about like what this really heavy, mysterious, serious music was. You know, it was very spiritual music too, and I think that's probably the main ingredient of it, is that it was spirit music. And that's what I found in rock and roll anyway, coming out of blues and jazz. With rock and roll, the aspects of rock and roll, I was interested in that. You know, I think what drew me into punk rock was first hearing Patti Smith, which was just all about being very spiritual on the microphone. I never thought of punk rock as being, you know, some kind of anti-religious music. I thought it had sort of a lot of religious overtone in it. You know, it's all about spirit, you know.
I should ask you about the first, if you can remember the first Sonic Youth show, because I think often events like that, they get, it's not just rose-tinted spectacles, but there's a kind of aura of magic. And then often the reality isn't quite as epoch-defining as the legend would like to purport. Well, how was it?
The first Sonic Youth show, under the name Sonic Youth, was at a art center in downtown Manhattan called The Kitchen, where they were doing like a downtown bands kind of presentation on different nights. And just because of our association with some of those people in that scene, they let us play, and we played. And that's when I first started introducing things into the group, such as, like, maybe this will sound better with the guitar stick underneath the 12th fret, and I sort of bang on it and turn the amp up a little louder. And then it started getting a little more intense and heavy, and that was really kind of creating a reaction, and not only for the audience of very few, but myself, you know. So yeah, that was the first gig, and I think I still have a flyer for it.
Really?
Actually, yeah.
When was the point that you first really felt that Sonic Youth had kind of found an audience?
When we first came overseas and we played very unceremoniously in London, we were pretty much tossed off the stage.
What happened?
We got a gig at a venue called The Venue, and it was Daniel Dax, who had a bit of a hit then. We were supposed to play second, and it was kind of a good time to play, and she said, well, no, I'm playing second. You lot have been abroad, and I have a hit, and I'm going to play second. And we're just like, no. Well, we had nobody to fight for us, so we went on first. And we were angry, and it was a very begrudging thing. And there wasn't very many people in the venue at that time, you know, for the first band, which was us. And we started playing, and we started smashing our guitars and screaming, and then Lee's guitar amp blew up, and smoke was coming out of it, and he was just like pointing at it and laughing, and there was two young lads leaning on the front of the stage just staring at us, and I could hear one of them go like, "This is brilliant." And I've always wondered what happened to these two people, because they were the very first fans in England. But what happened is the NME came out a few weeks later and they reviewed that gig. They said Sonic Youth were the best thing on eight legs this evening, and Daniel Dax they just had no time for, but the reviewer talked judiciously about how interesting we were. It was our first review. It was our first live review.
Really?
You know, it was like in the NME. And I remember reading that because I used to steal the NME from the Gem Spa, you know, the newsstand that you see on the back cover of the New York Dolls album cover. That's where I used to go, and I would steal the English newspapers and bring them home and read them. And I read that and just thinking like, oh, wow.
Mentioned Patti Smith. When was the first time that you experienced her? Because obviously, as another artist that everything she stands for and creates has got a certain honesty and realness and just
Patti Smith first came to my attention as a rock writer, and I would see her byline in Cream magazine, which was a magazine coming out of Detroit, Michigan, and it was being edited by, like, Lester Bangs was the editor in chief for a while, and it was a bit of a magazine of just wild voices, you know, and really engaged and intellectual and just sort of like taking musicians to task, you know, for whatever reasons. So I was curious about who this person who was writing all in lowercase was, and writing in a really sort of prosaic, poetic way, and then seeing a little ad for a 7-inch record called Hey Joe, and you would send away to this address in New York City. And I sent whatever measly dollars I had to get this 7-inch, because I was really curious what this rock writer sounded like, you know, this poet, rock writer, you know, she's a writer. And like the record came in the mail. It sounded like somebody had made it in their kitchen. You know, they just like set up a tape recorder and they made a record, and then that whole aesthetic of that was really unusual. I mean, you didn't really hear records that sounded like that. Everything was always just kind of this other kind of energy of, you know, the studio energy. This just sounded really raw.
Honey, the way you play guitar makes me feel so masochistic. The way you go down low, deep into the neck, and I would do anything, and I would do anything. And Patti Hearst, you standing there in front of the Symbionese Liberation Army flag with your legs spread, I was wondering, were you getting it every night from a black revolutionary man and his women, or were you really dead? And now that you are on the run, what goes on in your mind? Your sister, they sit by the window. You know your mama does a sit and cry. And your daddy, well, you know what your daddy said, Patti. You know what your daddy said, Patti? He said, well, 60 days ago, she was such a lovely child. Now here she is with a gun in her hand. Where you going with that?
This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest Thurston Moore, and that was Hey Joe by Patti Smith.
This is BBC Radio 6
Music.
6 Music.
6 Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on 6 Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Thurston Moore. And that was Money, performed by the Backbeat Band. That's a group that included Thurston, Greg Dulli of the Afghan Whigs, Mike Mills of REM, and Dave Grohl. They recorded the soundtrack to the movie Backbeat, which chronicled the early days of the Beatles in Hamburg. I listened to some of those tracks, and which were done for the Backbeat film. And yeah, you kind of play Beatles songs as if the Stooges were playing them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they're really great recordings. That must have been such fun.
It was super fun, yeah. I mean, the idea was that that's sort of what the kind of band they were. They were really like blood and guts, you know. I mean, the original recordings of the Beatles, like when you listen to the mono sessions they did early on those first records, they're savage.
Mm.
Those first mono mixes of the Beatles are just like, it's punk. So when we got asked to do that project, we tried to get the same amps and guitars that we knew that they might have been playing, you know, like when they were in
Hamburg.
That was a really fun time. It was super fun. I mean, we just hammered that stuff out. And for me, I don't really play really traditional orthodox bar chord rock. You know,
you can say that again.
So, I mean, I kind of knew how to play Smoke on the Water for a second, you know, like, or something, or even Louie Louie, you know, to some extent, but only the first measure. It was a crash course in playing primal day one rock and roll. It was great. You'd be a good group to regroup, actually.
Do it.
You know, people ask me about reunions all the time. I was like, that's a reunion I'll do.
Welcome on. Everybody.
Psychic Hearts was the first solo record, and you've got the new record coming out now, Rock and Roll Consciousness. How comfortably do you wear the kind of the, how would you describe it, the sort of mantle of indie godhead of avant-garde guitar? Because you are, you know, you're a bit of a a bit of a hero. You sort of forged a certain path and continue to do so, and you weave around. But, you know, people get quite excited. Us, Thurston Moore, well, there's a new record. He's going to play. are you comfortable with that?
I think I am, yeah. I certainly don't. I don't let it go to my head. I mean, I really appreciate it when people say nice things to me on the street, especially on days when I'm feeling disconsolate or whatever, and all of a sudden somebody will come around the corner and it'll be a businessman, you know, saying like, hey, thanks for making those records, or thanks for getting me through college, or, you know, oh, I just bought tickets to your Scala gig. And I was like, oh, cool. And I'm sitting at the bus stop, you know, like with my takeaway, you know, like, oh, that's cool. I mean, like, you know, those moments are always great. But I mean, I always feel like I'm always in this constant state of apprenticeship, you know. I'm always trying to find a place where I'm feeling like I'm working at the, you know, at a place where, you know, I'm doing the work I set out to do or whatever. I don't know. But I certainly feel with this new record, I found a really a good zone. Mm. Mentally, psychologically, passionately, you know,
philosophically,
to be in as a songwriter. I feel fairly like I'm ready. I'm really ready to go.
The apprenticeship is nearly over.
I guess maybe Sonic Youth was the apprenticeship.
Smoke of dreams, they pull you in to the crazy city's dim light. And the silhouettes that fall from grace, and they are laughing in love. Smoking ghosts find pleasure in your funny presence, sweetheart. They risk capture to be crushed, aroused in tune to cheap machines. Flashing time down the street, holding hands on the subway, and the smoking spirits, they will take you in. They wait for you in their shadow. New York City is everything. Sing the ghost dance healer. Smoke of dreams.
Also, when I was doing a bit of research, I found this excellent interview with Ewan Beck. Like, really, really early interview. And he looks about 7 years old.
Yeah.
And it's lovely. It's because you're both... It's, I think it was MTV.
Yeah.
Peace. When did you first meet? Because he's worked with you and you've worked with him. And it's kind of been a lovely creative relationship.
I heard about him in L.A. He was sort of bombing around L.A. playing between sets of different bands. Like, he would go on stage and play a few songs. And he was friends with some people. And I was in a record store right when he had done this 12-inch of Loser, before it was on the radio or anything. And I had heard it in the record store. Somebody was playing it. I was like, oh, that sounds great. And I bought it. And I remember bringing it to Mike D from the Beastie Boys house, who I was staying with at the time, and playing it. And he was just like, what is this? You know, because it was like, it was amazing. It was so great. This is this guy Beck, you know. And then we saw a flyer for a backyard barbecue with like 14 different groups, and Beck was listed amongst them. I was like, oh, let's go see this kid. And I remember we went to this thing. It was just a bunch of people hanging in a backyard. He was cool. He came out, he sort of looked like what you saw on the TV at that time, and he played a guitar, and he put it down, and he picked up a leaf blower, and he started playing leaf blower, and then he did a few backflips or something, and that was his act. And I was just like, okay, he's good.
Yo, bring it on down.
you remember people's reactions when they first found out that Sonic Youth would be going on an extended hiatus? Because you're a band that means something to people, you know? I remember people being, no, this, they can't. We've got to, there's got to be more records. They can't, no. This is not supposed to happen.
I think the band had a great run, and I think, you know, as far as like a final record, like the Eternal, which at the time I don't think we were really sort of looking at as the final record, but it is the final record, and I think it's as good a final record as any band could have hoped to make. I think we sort of set our piece quite a bit, you know, through the years since we were in early 80s into like early 2000s. So I don't feel like there's anything really left unsaid. I mean, we could have continued, and that's all very fine and well. But I do feel like even in those last few years touring, that there was a bit of a plateau had been reached, and I do feel like a lot of the audiences who were coming to see us because I mean, I think we would do a good job, but I always felt like there was a bit of a, maybe we had been decoded to a certain degree.
Interesting, you know? Word.
I think we've been figured out. We've been sussed, you know. It's just like, you know, so I felt like the audience is like, okay, that was nice. Let's go home now. Whereas before, it used to be like, oh my God, my head just got blown off. You know, like, where do we go now? I don't know. It's like, I'm really freaked out. This band just was like insane. I didn't really feel that happening anymore. I felt like, oh, okay. That's Sonic Youth. We're going to go home. I mean, I felt there was this bit of complacency going on in the response. And it wasn't like we were exacting any sort of hit record status where all of a sudden there was going to be this influx of new people and we're going to be this big explosive band. It was just it was on this really sort of steady plateau, which is fine. You know, I totally was grateful for it and just to be accepted by anybody. But I did feel like maybe there's some wheels were being spun, not so much creatively, but just sort of professionally. You know, and I had in my mind even then that I would like to sort of maybe go more into maybe some solo territory under my own name. But as the band did stop, it did allow me to really go into solo territory, which I'm doing, which is why, you know, here I am. But so, no, I don't really, I mean, you know, to me, I totally respect everybody's feelings about, like, it's too bad, you know, they don't play anymore. But we played for a long time, man. You know, so it's like...
Crawl.
What's the last thing we should play? It's the final question. You can pick anything we want to go out on the show. What would it be?
Let's play Time Has Come by Ann Briggs. And I want to play this song because I think Ann Briggs represents so much of what's beautiful about England. And it really draws me into an English state of place, a state of mind, is her voice, and always has. And I had just done a cross-country trip across the USA with my 22-year-old daughter, and she was DJing in the car. And she played all this cool stuff, you know, from Solange to Beyonce. But then she played Ann Briggs, and I was like, wow, how do you know about Ann Briggs? She goes, because I used to listen to your records. Didn't you know that? She goes, I love this singer. I said, well, this is where I live now.
It's good to speak to you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
This is Six Music. We'll be right back.
I'm just interested in just mishmashing the sound and see what you get.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems, and long forgotten favorites.
Well, we don't have a set list. We're trying to ensure that every show is different.
This is Old Noughties on BBC Sound.
Thank you.